unbridled passions of all sorts don't seem out of place. Propaganda passes best in this format. The Moranbong Band also does its own version of old DPRK classics, showing how the flashy sounds of the moment build on this illustrious canon. The slow, sentimental numbers clearly have their roots in songs like 1961's We Have Nothing to Envy in This World, one of the first songs children are taught in school, while the upbeat pop tracks belong to a lineage that includes Whistle from the late 1980s, with its instrumental medley slyly hijacked from ABBA's Gimme 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 A Man After Midnight, and which was subsequently used for Madonna's 2005 single, Hung Up. Hey, a global pop canon! I admit that Norcore sounds like a rather heavy-handed riff on hardcore, a slightly absurd commentary on both the intensity of the state-sanctioned sound's content and the implicit violence contained therein. But the core, besides being short for Korean, can also be thought of as the core of overbaked emotion, of sentimentality that drenches each of these songs. Like Japanoise and other regional subgenres of extreme sonic expression, Norcore is not likely to gain the mass international following of K-pop. Though in design, it's certainly catchy enough to appeal to the masses. Chapter 26. Entertainment for the masses, by the masses. Mass expression has always been a canonical form of entertainment in the DPRK. Up until 2013, the annual event that attracted the most visitors to the country was the Arirang Festival, also known as the Mass Games. Arirang is a folk story that is used as an allegory of Korea's division, in which a young couple is torn apart by the wiles of an evil landlord. The story went on to become a popular song, which was also popular in South Korea at one point, but has become something of an unofficial national anthem in the North. Featuring more than 100,000 performers, among them acrobats, athletes, singers, dancers, brass bands, banner and flag-wielding marshals, oh my! The Arirang Festival enacted the revolutionary history of the country in 90 minutes on uber-monumental scale, the likes of which can't be seen anywhere else. Or, to be precise, would be impossible to reproduce elsewhere. As I heard one overexcited tourist exclaim, "This could never happen in a capitalist country. We're just not organized enough." I attended one of the final iterations of Arirang in 2012 on my second trip to the DPRK. Word at the time was that a whole new spectacle was being planned for the future, but it has yet to materialize. The mass games, it seems, are a relic of the Kim Jong-il era. The Arirang Festival had originally been invented by Kim Jong-il in 1972 as part of his father's birthday succession, though that's yet another dubious claim, as mass gymnastics demonstrations had also been a mainstay throughout the Soviet realm, and before that were a showpiece of a number of nationalist movements in Europe in the 19th century. Originality aside, Kim and his cinematic staff spectacularized the event, transforming it into yet another achievement of succession art, along with many of the monuments making up contemporary Pyongyang. The scene outside the Rungrado Stadium that night was reminiscent of the organizational nature of most activity in the DPRK. When people aren't following instructions, they're often standing around or squatting, waiting to be told what to do. Families stood in clusters around a fountain, watching it spit water under the illumination of a revolving rainbow of colored lights. Several regiments of soldiers stood in line, waiting for their orders to march into the stadium and take their seats in the Korean-only section of the stadium. Besides soldiers, the most ubiquitous group was the red-scarved members of the Children's Union, who were more amenable to smiling and waving at the foreign tourists sequestered at the rear of the parking lot, as our guides counted heads and issued tickets. Finally, the spectacle of the costumed performers themselves marching orderly toward the rear of the stadium. The enormity of what we were about to witness became evident the moment we entered the stadium to take our seats, with thousands of flag-bearing marshals lined up on the stadium floor. Behind them stood another several thousand young girls in gymnast attire. 20,000 schoolchildren flipped colored cards in perfect synchronicity to form the world's largest LED screen. A start cue was issued somehow, somewhere. The children shouted out, "Hey!" The marshals on the ground stepped forward and then swooped back as thousands of young women in Chosenot came surging forth. Lights dimmed, and a festive symphony swelled, as did the adrenaline of the crowd. The narrative begins in 1905, a relatively idyllic time in the nation's history, only to be soured 5 years later when the country comes under occupation by Japan. Rather than dwelling on the ruthless nature of the Japanese imperialists, there is plenty of that in DPRK cinema and literature. There is an emphasis on the inherent goodness and purity of the Korean people here. A female vocalist sings Arirang. Painted mountain scenes unfold across the live LED screen. A traditional fan dance is performed by rows of thousands of women on the stadium floor below. Suddenly, a red sunrise appears, signaling the birth of Kim Il-sung. The audience breaks into applause. The history of the nation begins. Two pistols, inherited by the country's eternal president upon Kim Hyong-jik's death in 1926, according to the official history, flash their way across the screen as dancers in military garb march below in clockwork synchronicity. The guns, it is said, were used by the family patriarch in the anti-Japanese revolutionary struggle. Kim Jong-il would inherit the same two pistols from his father, as presumably would Kim Jong-un, legitimizing, through symbolism, the filial succession. And then there are the kids. The ones we cannot see, of course, who form the background screen on the opposite side of the stadium. But then a circus instrumental plays, and thousands come running across the field, landing in perfect lines and embarking upon a routine of synchronized cuteness, much to the delight of the squealing audience. "Children are the kings of our nation," Kim Il-sung was fond of saying. But look at them out there, smiling and, well, just perfect. How do they do it? The answer is simple. In the DPRK, they aren't raised by their parents. They're raised by the state. Most of the tourists who watched the Arirang Festival could little understand the symbolism. But that's fine as well. What's unmissable in such extravaganzas is the dynamic symbiosis that emerges in the energy field formed between the performers and the audience. The real intended audience, of course, is the Korean people, who simultaneously serve as the performers. In the course of the ritual, any division between us and them, participant and audience member, is dissolved in the experiential spectacle of mass being. Nobody knows for sure why the mass games came to an end. Some speculate that the new regime recognized how deeply unpopular they were among the participants, particularly the parents of the schoolchildren drafted to form that LED screen. The year-long preparations for the performances were famously grueling and torturous, with children pulled out of school for months at a time to learn how to flip those pages perfectly. Some say that the kids weren't even allowed to use the bathroom for hours during rehearsals, flipping pages over and over, learning to subordinate their thoughts, actions, and bladder to the collective will. Chapter 27. The establishment of school children's palaces throughout the country is a testament to not only North Koreans' love of children and devotion to their care, but to their willingness to foster talent for propagandistic purposes from an early age. It is here, in after-school extracurricular lessons, where the country's most talented tots may nurture their natural abilities from early on in life. After the mass dance, we ride across town to the school children's palace of Manyongdae, the district where Kim Il-sung was born. This is the most prestigious of these training grounds. Among other distinguished alumni, most members of the Moranbong band trained at Manyongdae. A visit to the schoolchildren's palace is one of those classic, well-choreographed DPRK tourism experiences, Since it was renovated in 2015 under Kim Jong-un's instructions, one of the star attractions now is the architecture and remodeled interior, which at times threatens to outshine the children. The scale of the building is truly palatial, a massive glass and concrete semicircle that is meant to evoke the embrace of the supreme leaders Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, whose official state portraits occupy the front and center of that circle, just above the main entrance doors. Above them, a glass-encased, flying saucer-esque structure must offer great views of surrounding Kwangbok Street. Before the entrance, we pass by one of Mansudae Art Studio's kitschier copper creations, two winged horses, the Cholima Beast, with a wagon full of overjoyed children pulling the reins. The nation's kings have arrived. Once we get inside, the eye-grabbing fun begins. After passing by the bright, illuminated urn-shaped wall relief, where a handwritten blessing by Kim Il-sung has been etched in gold lettering, we glide through the corridors, which, from floor to ceiling, have been doused in color according to the themes of the various sports and art forms pursued here. At certain points, the ceiling opens up to reveal all 8 floors, whence multi-hued chandeliers descend. A young pioneer-scarved girl leads us through a series of ornate halls. The Hall of Science showcases a huge floor relief of the Korean Peninsula, behind which stands the replica of a satellite missile branded with the DPRK flag. The Hall of Arts features a massive wall painting of a musical staff, rendered in rainbow lines extending in a bright blue sky, beneath which sits a purple stage that upholds a grand piano. The hallways are dotted with framed color photographs documenting visits by Kim Il-sung, Jong-il, and Jong-un, surrounded by admiring youngsters. Next, we're taken through a series of classrooms where we get to witness the prodigies in action. In a rehearsal room with gleaming hardwood floors, a prima donna conducts a class of young female dancers in black dress and pink bonnets. One class is devoted to the kayagum, perhaps the most typical Korean instrument, a series of thick, rope-like strings erected by pegs across a wooden board, requiring a muscular expenditure of force, pressed fingers on one hand, a firm pluck with the other. In another, a junior accordion orchestra delivers an instrumental rendition of "We Have Nothing to Envy in This World." Other classes are devoted to the visual arts. Children as young as 5 practice calligraphic strokes on paper, dipping their horsehair brushes into inky wells beneath the approving smiles of the leaders' portraits. The more advanced students, seated on the other side of the classroom, are already rendering full propaganda banners in elegant running script. Another room has children as young as 5 working on elaborate floral needlepoint textiles. The visit culminates in a performance. In the auditorium, we are seated in front of a row of teenagers in matching uniform, the girls in tasteful blue and white chosunot, the boys in white short-sleeved dress shirts and navy slacks. "Zionichi Koreans," Alec whispers. Zionichi is a Japanese word meant to designate temporary residents of that country. But Zionichi Koreans are actually permanent residents of Japan, their families having been there for generations. Most trace their family background to the colonial period, when Koreans immigrated to Japan for work or study opportunities, and then remained after Korea's liberation and subsequent division. A formidable ethnic minority, often discriminated against. And like many ethnic minorities the world over, they formed their own community within the larger society, in part, at least, as a result of this stigmatization. In post-war Japan, 2 Zionichi Korean organizations emerged to protect and promote the interests of the minority. Mindan was loyal to South Korea, but far more popular, at least in the beginning, was the pro-Pyongyang Chongryon Association. Chongryon was one of the main forces behind the voluntary repatriations of ethnic Koreans from Japan to the DPRK, begun in 1959. Thanks to deeply ingrained racism, xenophobia, and political paranoia, it didn't take much prodding to get support for this exodus from the Japanese government. which was eager to get rid of as many Koreans as possible. Until the spring of 1960, North Korea managed to settle the new arrivals successfully, at a rate of around 1,000 per week. These earliest arrivés seem to have been the luckiest, with many of them rewarded with apartments in Pyongyang, in what was considered a propaganda coup for the DPRK government. Early letters sent back to relatives in Japan often contained positive words about their new living conditions. But then, as time wore on and more settlers arrived to their new old homeland, those letters began to dry up. When letters did make it back to Japan, they were often disturbing in content, consisting largely of words of flattery for Kim Il-sung and platitudes about the glories of life under socialism, ending with requests at the end for the family to send basic necessities that even the poorest of the poor had easy access to in Japan, which seemed to contradict all those preceding statements about their bounteous new life. Cryptic references to hard work and implications of resettlement in remote, far-flung rural locations were intended as warnings to family members remaining in Japan that they might wish to reconsider their intention to make the same journey. Others would conceal more bluntly discouraging warnings in minuscule script behind the postage stamp. From some of those repatriates who managed to subsequently escape North Korea during the famine of the 1990s, we now have a better idea of what happened to many of them. What at first was a propaganda coup eventually became a burden, a strain on the DPRK's limited resources, as the settlers arrived in ever-increasing numbers. Most of them could see immediately the wide gap between what they had been promised and the reality of life in their new homeland. Waiting for them at the harbor of Chongjin on the east coast, where they would ultimately land, a cheerless mass of locals would be organized to greet them with chants, songs, and bouquets. The Zainichi Koreans on those boats would later describe how a wave of disappointment descended upon them the minute they saw the shabby clothing and sunburnt faces, the gray, ugly buildings forming the cityscape, and once they were off the boat, the empty shelves in the shops. At first, some of the Zainichi Korean families managed to thrive in the north. Those with family members still in Japan could arrange to receive regular shipments of money and goods that they could barter, sell, or enjoy for themselves, much to the envy of ordinary Koreans, who would often turn against them for these reasons. And many of them fell victim to more official forms of discrimination, because having lived their earliest lives in enemy territory, they were considered politically suspect. It is not known how many eventually ended up in the gulag, but at least one defector, Kong Chol-hwan, himself a Zainichi Korean who was interned with his family at the Yorok concentration camp, maintains that a great number of them suffered similar political persecution. After South Korea normalized relations with Japan in 1965, the repatriation program tapered off, though it would continue on a smaller scale until 1984. These days, there are no new settlers, but the Chongryon Association is still going strong, maintaining a network of schools in Japan where Zainichi Koreans grow up learning of the great exploits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. Each summer, teenage Zainichi Koreans are sent by their families to Pyongyang, where they enjoy a program of tourism and cultural and educational activities. The lights dim. A small girl, about 6 years old, smile plastered across her face, makes her way to the microphone. She welcomes the audience, which seems to be composed mostly of parents in addition to the foreign tour groups, in the quivering style of overbearing excitement famously employed by DPRK nightly newscaster Ri Chun-hee, a style that is probably rooted in the melodramatic Japanese Shinpa theater that was popular during the colonial period, something that most Koreans today are likely unaware of. She gracefully floats off stage, the red curtains part, music swells from the orchestra pit, and the spectacle is launched, missile-like, at full force. The performance is structured as a variety show, featuring one magisterial act after another. Many are rooted in ancient Korean art forms, with a good dose of DPRK-style propaganda added to give it all a contemporary flavor. A group of girls performed the bukacham, an elaborate traditional fan dance. A chubby 5-year-old boy belts out a solo in a piercing alto that could wake Ethel Merman from her death slumber. Another boy executes an impressive routine of clown acrobatics. A solo dancer places a porcelain urn upon her head and spins wildly across the stage, never once losing her balance or breaking the wide smile plastered across her face. A chorus of 8 teenage girls sing a melody accompanied by a boy accordion player. Another group of accordionists battle each other at top speed. The accordion is a favorite instrument, and some musicians outside the country claim that the DPRK manufactures the finest specimen. In the penultimate performance, before a widescreen shot of the Triphalic Party Monument, a full adolescent orchestra comprising both Western and traditional Korean instruments, conducted by a 13-year-old boy in a young pioneer scarf, plays the backing soundtrack as a young girl makes her way toward the lip of the stage, reciting a poem about the glories of the motherland. She is then joined by 2 lookalikes, adorned in the same outfit, and the trio launch into a harmonized paean to the wonders of the Workers' Party. A pre-adolescent girl, swathed in chosonot, performs a dizzying solo on a set of 8 Korean leather barrel drums. She is joined by an entire stage of petite drummer boys and girls, each strapped to a single drum of varying size and shape, who join in on the fast, complex rhythm. Together, they operate as a single machine, bowing to wild applause when the final beat is hit. Everything executed with pitch-perfect precision. Every move graceful, every note hit, no matter how high. The curtains rise and fall at the precise moment. Even when motion does not take center stage, when it is a chorus of children singing a song of praise for their leader, all exhale and sway in effortless synchronicity, as though attached to the same battery. There is something chilling about it, though such reflections only come later, after the final bows have been taken. Making our way to the van, we pass by the Zainichi kids having a group photo taken in front of the palace. Sitting behind us in the darkened auditorium and adorned in this typical clothing, they could nearly pass as ordinary North Korean teenagers. Seeing them in broad daylight now is a disruption to the senses. "Look how tall they are," I whisper to Alec. And it's true. They tower over the North Korean adults surrounding them. Their hair is naturally shiny and of the deepest black. Their complexion clear. Their skin white, in stark contrast to the sunburnt faces of most North Korean men. Pockmarks denoting childhood malnutrition, noticeably absent. In a word, they look healthy. Seeing them standing there, cheerfully hugging one another with smiles unforced, it becomes shockingly apparent that they come from a very different world. I'm jolted when I realize how normalized the stunted appearance of North Koreans has become by now. 3 weeks in, and it's starting to feel a little like home. Chapter 28. To know and not to know. To be conscious of complete truthfulness while telling carefully constructed lies. To hold simultaneously 2 opinions which canceled out, knowing them to be contradictory and believing in both of them. To use logic against logic. To repudiate morality while laying claim to it. To believe that democracy was impossible and that the party was the guardian of democracy. To forget whatever it was necessary to forget, then to draw it back into memory again at the moment when it was needed, and then promptly to forget it again. And above all, to apply the same process to the process itself. That was the ultimate subtlety. Consciously to induce unconsciousness, and then once again to become unconscious of the act of hypnosis you had just performed. Even to understand the word doublethink involved the use of doublethink. George Orwell, 1984. Our final stop on this busy Victory Day tour is on the outskirts of Pyongyang, in a rural area. It's newly opened, and none of us, including Min and Ro, have been here before. We know nothing about it, other than its status as a revolutionary site, which designates any place where one of the leaders carried out activities of national importance. These sites play a pivotal role in fomenting state mythography. One such revolutionary site is Kim Il-sung's native home in Manyongdae, near the schoolchildren's palace. Another is Kim Jong-il's fake birthplace on Mount Paektu. Our van makes its way down a long, narrow drive, surrounded by immaculately manicured lawns and ornate landscape architecture. Every rock polished, each flowerbed formation enunciated in perfect geometrical flourish. "What the fuck is this? The wonderful land of Oz?" I whisper to Alec. He shakes his head. Alexander has no idea either. We get out of the van. Soldiers everywhere. Most of them manual labor units at menial tasks, putting the final perfecting touch on the accumulated sheen. The echoed commands of a battle drill can be heard in the distance. A unit marches past, singing the chorus of "Let's go to Mount Paektu."
"Is there a military base nearby?" I ask innocently.
"That's not a question I would feel comfortable asking," Min warns with an awkward smile.
"Don't know and don't want to know."
"Okay, then." A young female soldier and older male officer approach our vehicle. She'll be our guide, and he's there to monitor all that is said and done until we vacate the premises. It's one of those places. Sensitive.
"Comrade Min," the guide exclaims with surprise. "Comrade Lee Kyung-sim,"
Min responds, emitting a bolt of laughter. Turns out they were in the same class at the University of Foreign Studies, though they hardly knew each other. Still, something about this chance meeting has them both stifling giggles.
"So I guess you don't need me to interpret," Min says to her former classmate. "You can do the tour in English yourself. Your English is probably even better than mine."
Comrade Lee shakes her head firmly in the negative, a brief sideways glance acknowledging the presence of the senior officer next to her. She launches into her introductory spiel, leaving Min no choice but to translate for us. We are welcomed to the Gongiri Revolutionary Site, where Kim Il-sung spent late 1950 to 1953 commanding the Korean War. Or so they would like us to believe. I raise my camera to take a photo of the artificial hillside grass cave entrance. Min raises her arm in front of my lens just as fast.
"You can leave your camera in the van, Travis."
She smiles. No photos here. Inside the cave, an open-floor museum has been created. We are led through a series of installations, the highlight of which is Kim Il-sung's office, where, we are told, he held more than 200 meetings. Fake stars glimmer from the night blue ceiling above. The office is a theatrical stage set with desks and chairs that look like restored high-end antiques, gleaming with a fresh paint job. "Is this the original office?" I ask. "Or a recreation?"
"It's the original office."
Comrade Lee and the senior officer study my face, as though trying to gauge whether I'm buying it.
"Oh, wow."
I give them a wide-eyed nod. The guide points to a bullet hole in the wall, evidence from the day the enemy attempted to assassinate our general. "Well, it looks as real as anything else here." The path takes us through a series of military tunnels out the back, where we are shown a small classroom. This is where the dear leader Kim Jong-il took his lessons while his father worked in his office. Out of the corner of my eye, I spy Ro trailing behind us, typically silent, but attempting to stifle his laughter. This was the bedroom of the dear leader Kim Jong-il from June 25, 1952 to August 16, 1952. A simple affair with a tiny child-sized bed covered in a pink and white striped sheet, garish red carpeting, and a small table with a tablecloth of a clashing shade of red.
Like the office, this sacred ground is roped off to prevent visitors from sullying it with footprints. As we circle our way back toward the parking lot, we meet an arriving tour group, this one composed wholly of soldiers. They seem more interested in us than the introductory spiel their guide is presenting. We pause between four chairs arranged in a circle in front of the cave's entrance. This is where Kim Il-sung met with the first three hero soldiers of the Fatherland Liberation War. I study the chairs, puzzled by a sense of déjà vu. That's when it hits me. I have the same chair at home in Berlin. Who knew IKEA exported its designs to Korea in the 1950s? The day ends with another sporadic appearance by Comrade Kim, eager to check on the status of his latest pet project. "I want to show you my favorite bar in Pyongyang," he tells us in the van. The joint he takes us to is brand new, hidden down an alleyway behind the Tower of the Jucha Idea on the eastern banks of the Taedong River. On the ground floor is a shop vending the usual miscellany and a pharmacy selling a range of imported medicine, from Tylenol to antibiotics, behind a glass display case. Upstairs, the bar is rendered in exquisite oak paneling and varnished wood tables. Everything glistens, and save for the Moranbong girls on TV, you could easily be in an upmarket sports bar in Chicago or Boston. The tables are filled with Donju and Chinese business people. They stare at us with bemusement, unaccustomed to seeing Western foreigners here. Comrade Kim orders beers and kimchi pancakes for the table. "So," he says, "I heard you went to Gonjiri today. Now you know the true history behind the Korean War." As he smiles at me, he gives me a sly wink. Kim, as we have learned, is the son of a prominent officer. It suddenly dawns on me. Of course, he must know the truth. They all must know. All the prominent families here, they are the descendants of the people who fought in the war. People who were actually there. Who must have passed down the stories from generation to generation. Pyongyang was bombed to near total annihilation. The entire city was destroyed. Kim Il-sung and his closest advisors, the entire Politburo, had to be evacuated to the border with China, where they remained until the war came to an end and they could safely return to Pyongyang. Gonjiri, like Kim Jong-il's birthplace on Mount Paektu, is a total stage set. "Let's talk," says Alexander, as we make our way down the hall to our rooms. These nightly chats are a means for both of us to retain our sanity as the days wear on. Alexander starts venting right away, in the whisper we've taken to adapting as a measure of safety whenever we're alone.
"Do you really think anyone believes this shit? They are all mentally ill. They have to be."
From my balcony, we look out onto the lights of the city before their nightly extinguishment. I've been having my own mental travails of late, though that's not something I'm eager to share. They've manifested themselves in the past days in difficulty getting to sleep at night. Thankfully, I prepared for this inevitability in advance by bringing a stash of sleeping pills.
"Fucking crazy," he continues. "This whole system, a system of ass-kissing is what it is. It started with Kim Il-sung, his sick fetish for Stalin, and the next one who exacerbated it all to get in his father's good graces. And this one now? He has no choice but to continue it, and doesn't have the brains to do it any other way."
"But what about what Simon told us?" I ask.
"Simon who?" "Businessman Simon, the Chinese guy. He implied that number three wanted to change the system. It's the old men surrounding him, his advisors, the old guard, who won't let that happen."
"I don't buy that."
"Then what's going on in his head? Is it that he grew up so sheltered in his Swiss chalet that he doesn't know what's real and what's not?"
"It's partly that he doesn't know," Alexander speculates, "and partly that he doesn't care. They're afraid of him, so they have to hide certain things from him. But the reality they do show can be just as deceiving. The songs they sing for him? The constant reminders of who he is?
which is who his father and grandfather were. But here's my theory. It's the tears that get him the most. Tears are a powerful thing. The people sobbing with joy wherever he goes. I think he must see them and think to himself, hey, those are real tears, not something you can fake. Sure, I do some bad things, but when the people see me, they cry because they love me. They really love me.
And those bad things? I contribute to this exercise in armchair psychology.
He can rationalize those. Things he has to do, that he's been forced into doing. Because of his position in life. Who he is, what he was born into.
The ones I feel the most sorry for are the people on the ground who have to deal with the foreigners, says Alexander. Not guides like Min and Ro. They have some distance from it all. I'm talking about the minders who get tasked with accompanying the NGO workers, the foreign embassy officials. They're the ones who really have to live the contradiction. The ones who see the truth and know what's really going on and then have to lie on the spot. Going out into the countryside to find out what happened while the food or medicine, seeing what really happened, and then having to invent a lie to tell the foreigners. Having to deny that what is there in front of them is real. At the end of the day, imagine how fucked up their heads must be.
It reminds me of something my teacher said the other day in class. We were learning some new vocabulary, something to do with food and drink. The teacher was giving an example of a sentence. When I have a headache, I drink alcohol. I thought, wait, that doesn't make sense. He must mean something like, when he drinks too much, he gets a headache. Then I realized, no, I had understood the sentence correctly. He drinks when he gets a headache. Your head must ache at night with all this bullshit, all these lies you can't even begin to unravel. This fake victory, this triumph of socialism that is really a triumph of oppression. Your head aches from it all, and you want nothing more than to have a drink, to annihilate all the wreckage in your mind.
Alexander studies the dim glare of the city blanketed before us. What were the North Koreans you met in Dubai like? I ask. Did they still believe in the system? In any of it?
Some do, some don't. Alexander replies. They've seen the outside world, and they're torn. They suffer from, let's call it an inner conflict.
Double consciousness, I offer. Chinese intellectuals talk about this.
What it comes down to is dedication and belief. Those are two different things. There are some who genuinely believe in the system. Then there are those who are dedicated to it without necessarily believing in it. I met both types in Dubai. As foreigners, of course, we will never, ever meet someone who is not benefiting from the system in some way or other. That's what makes it hard to gauge what it is they actually believe. That's where the dedication comes in. You might think it's all bullshit, a lie, but you don't want it to end if you know how it works and it's rewarding you.
So I guess you weren't serious about kimchi baguette.
No, of course not, Alexander spits. These joint ventures? Ha! This is how it works. They take your expertise, they use it, you teach them until they've mastered it. Then they see they have no further use for you, and you, and your investment, are shuttled out of the picture. It's happened to a lot of businessmen who have tried to do joint ventures here. Oh, sorry, because of the political situation, we can't get you a visa. And your funds? They are frozen in the bank here. We can't get them out. Sorry, and have a nice day. A childlike criminality pervades this entire system. The people's sense of right and wrong is completely perverted. This government that defaults on its foreign loans and then brags about it in the state media to its own people. What a great business model! That's why the economy is in the dumps, has been for so long. They can't get any credit from anyone, anywhere. The only way they can do business is the criminal way. To do business here as a foreigner is to set yourself up to get robbed.
But you don't think the Donju are the ones who are going to change the system. People like Min and Kim? These are enlightened people. They know how it works in the outside world.
I don't think anyone can change the system, Alexander says. It's too late for that. And you want to know why? It's because the people who designed the system are dead. The last syllable, though whispered, cuts a resonant swath through the night air, sending a chill up my neck. A factory on the Potong River suddenly emits a strange fiery light into the night sky. The thought that all this has been solidified into an inalterable permanency, that nothing, no imaginable shift in the narrative, can ever arise, no hope on the horizon. In my exhausted state, it is too much to take. Alexander sees from the expression on my face that he has gone too far, wishes me good night, and retreats to his room. Belief and dedication. One can be expressed through words, the other only through action. There is, of course, an entire spectrum that lies between. I want to believe there are more directions in this moral compass than what has been sketched out. Beyond the dumb naivete of blind obedience and the pure selfishness of cynically upholding it for personal gain. I close my blinds to the creepy solitude of my empty hotel room. As muddy as the facts are, as impenetrable as something that's supposed to be crystal clear as truth is in this confused place, there is still something that we cannot access, a togetherness spawned by these mad and perilous conditions, a unity that we will never fully have access to. Those ties that bind, that cannot be expressed in language, for it is far too dangerous, but make themselves apparent in other ways, a sly grin, a wink. It is, after all, a kind of victory. Not in any war, whether real or imagined, but victory in the sense of endurance, of survival. Part 7. Houses of Friendship. Chapter 29. It starts to make sense after a while. The vowel combos no longer appear or sound like such odd juxtapositions, but come across as familiar as the face of a friend you see every day. Together with the consonants, they merge into words that sound not so distant from English after all. Even the syntax of the sentences, which seems exactly backward to an anglicized ear, becomes less of an obstacle as it solidifies into a logic. I'm on the precipice of understanding. 3 weeks in, Pyongyang has grown used to our appearance on its streets, and we feel ourselves growing less immune to the mindfuckery of everyday life in which everyone around us is enmeshed. A small conspiracy emerges among our teachers at Kim Hyong-jik University, and their whisperings have reached Min, who is only too eager to stir the pot. One day after class, on our way to lunch, she announces, "Travis is winning." "What on earth are you talking about?" we ask her. She relays that our professors have designed an impromptu ranking system and determined that I have made the most progress. "And Alexander," she reports glumly, "is the worst." "But that's not really fair," I protest. "We're at three different levels. I started out at the lowest as a total beginner, so of course I'm going to make the fastest progress, because my course is the easiest." Min shakes her head. "Ms. Park said that it takes her Chinese students 1 month to learn what you mastered in the first week." "But why compare me to them? And why compare the three of us to each other? Alec is pretty much fluent, so any progress he makes is going to be negligible. At a certain point, there's just not much more you can learn. And Alexander is right in the middle, which is the most challenging part when learning any new language. You of all people should know that, Min. I'm sure learning Spanish wasn't such a walk in the park." Min and the others listen to my argument in silence, but I get the feeling that they're dismissing it as false modesty. And since it's all rather embarrassing, especially for Alexander, everyone silently agrees to let the subject go. If only Min would let it. Over the course of the following days, she continues to bring it up whenever we're in the van traveling somewhere. Moments, I've come to realize, of unofficially designated privacy, where we can all talk relatively freely without worrying about who might be listening in. Even though she usually brings it up teasingly, it's clearly an act of passive aggression. Finally, one afternoon when Min is seated next to Alexander in the middle row of seats, with Alec and me behind them in the van, she turns to him with a more serious expression.
"I spoke to your teacher today," she says. "He's very frustrated. He says you're not learning." "What's wrong, Alexander? Why are you not studying at night?"
"I am studying," he explodes.
"How can you say that?
I'm studying most nights together with you."
It's true. I've been opting for alone time in my room. Alec and Alexander, on the other hand, have taken to spending a couple hours each night reviewing their lessons with Min and Ro in the lobby after dinner.
"But it's obviously not working," Min says. "You're not retaining what we learned. Your teacher keeps complaining about you."
"Look, I told you over and over again, I need the dictionary app. There are many new words, new grammar, and there is no English explanation in the text they are giving us. I can't go online to get it. The teacher does not speak any English or French. This makes it very difficult to learn."
"But Ro and I have been helping you at night, explaining everything, and you still don't understand."
"How many Korean words do you know?" Ro suddenly interjects.
"I don't know," says Alexander, taken aback. "Do you know how many English words you know?"
"Yes," he replies satisfactorily. 4,373 words. A silence as we all take this in. As though memorizing a list of words is the key to learning a language. But maybe this kind of quantitative assessment is the norm here. Ro is, after all, a graduate of the University of Foreign Studies.
"You can't possibly explain everything he's giving me each day," Alexander goes on.
"And I can't possibly learn everything the minute you explain it. It takes time. I am not Travis. I am not Alec. It's not fair of you to compare us like that. I have to learn at my own pace, and you have to accept it." Min remains silent for the rest of the ride. When I look over, I notice there is a tear running down her cheek. Alexander's take on the situation is that this kind of passive aggression is an internalized symptom of totalitarian mass psychology, and that Min probably doesn't even realize she's doing it. That everyone here is traumatized by the bullying they are victims of from a young age, and so in turn they take every opportunity to terrorize those who are perceived to be in any way beneath them on the social scale. Such a top-down structure of terror, Alexander reasons, is key to ensuring that no groups are formed. Because groups always pose a threat. They have to be broken up. I have my doubts. Then I notice our teachers getting in on the act. My bladder's always full at break time, so I make my way to the men's room at the end of the hall. There's no plumbing, just a waist-high tiled sink filled with water and a small bucket on the side. After pissing, I go to the sink, fill the bucket with water, pour it in the urinal. If you shit in one of the two squat toilet stalls, several trips from the sink to the toilet are required to clean up after yourself. I'm coming out of the bathroom one morning when I catch the gist of an exchange between Alec and Ms. Park. Alec makes the customary bow expected of university students when passing a professor in the hall.
"How are you doing today, comrade?" Ms. Park stops to ask. "You look a bit under the weather."
Alec gives a weak smile. "I'm okay. I just haven't heard from my girlfriend since I've been here. I've sent her several texts, but she hasn't responded."
"Well," replies Ms. Park coolly, "we have a saying in Korean you might find useful to learn. Out of sight, out of mind."
She smiles and sashays toward the teacher's office, shutting the door gently behind her. As our course nears its end, Ms. Park has developed an affection toward me that at times feels maternal, at others flirtatious. Not only am I the first American student she's ever had, the first American she's encountered in the flesh, actually, I am also her oldest student. At 36, I'm only 2 years younger than she is. There's a mischievous jokester in her that endears her to me. She flutters her eyelids when we get onto family vocabulary, and I tell her, in response to her query about my domestic arrangements, that I'm not married. Then she laughs out loud at her own daring. Like Min, she has a certain no-nonsense toughness at her core, though she is less likely to take her position of authority very seriously. As the days progress, she grows increasingly eager to use the themes of the lessons as prompts for conversation about our personal lives. These conversations take place in a whisper, but also seem quite relaxed. The door is left open for the entirety of the lesson, but footsteps are almost never heard in the hallway. She asks about my apartment in Berlin. I draw a map of the floor outline for her. We determine that we more or less share the same square footage. She nods her head at this, intensely interested. She asks whether I keep a diary. I tell her yes, that I write more or less every day. How about you?
Yes, she says, but only for special occasions, or if I am feeling sad.
She makes a mock, sad face to illustrate, and then bursts out laughing. Though the way she laughs implies that that might be a bit more often than she'd care to admit. Besides the photography incident with the leader's portraits early on, there is only one other time when I sense external forces meddling with our lessons. One day, as Ms. Park is sitting at the desk next to mine, watching as I complete a writing assignment, she looks up at me with doe eyes, a sweet look of nurturing sincerity she gives whenever she's genuinely impressed with my progress.
"Comrade Travis," she whispers with a sly smile, "I think when you go back to your country, perhaps you will get a job in Washington. You have learned much about Korea. Perhaps you could be of use to your country."
I understand immediately what she is implying, and also intuit that she hasn't thought up the question herself, but has likely been put up to it. I shake my head firmly, launching into my elementary Korean. No work in politics. No work for government. Me, writer, intellectual, like you. Brush on the Workers' Party monument. Novelist. She appears visibly relieved. Excited, even.
Novelist? Yes, novelist.
She claps her hands, as though she's finally got me all figured out, and obviously quite relieved. On earlier trips, I was always afraid of revealing my actual vocation. Western journalists are forbidden from entering the DPRK on a tourist visa. And although I have never considered myself a journalist, I realize that the fine distinction between writer and journalist is obscure to many people, perhaps especially those in positions of power. When applying to visit China, another communist country, I once had a visa rejected for putting writer in the job description field. By the time I visited Cuba for the first time in 2015, I knew better than to admit this on my visa application. From a U.S. perspective, it is too easy to bemoan this as further evidence of the lack of freedom of the press. But from the perspective of these countries, they are, in fact, engaged in an international propaganda battle against the media of the Western, U.S.-led First World. A battle that they have long been losing. Whether we wish to admit this to ourselves or not, the fact remains that nearly all our reporting on North Korea is ideological. Diligent observers of the media might have noticed that, despite our freedom of the press, there seems to be an unwritten rule that nothing positive can be reported about North Korea. This unofficial yet consensually agreed-upon policy seems to encourage or allow for a willful neglect of the rigorous fact-checking that any other subject warrants. Of course, the reasoning goes, it is impossible to carry out normal fact-checking procedures with anything Pyongyang-related, since normal journalism does not exist there, and the regime is so belligerent and intentionally lies to its own people. Then there's the language barrier. Few Western media outlets employ fluent Korean speakers. The remedy to both these problems, more often than not, is to rely on translated South Korean news dispatches with regard to the North. Yet this problematically overlooks South Korea's own ideological bias against the North. South Korea has been engaged in a propaganda war against North Korea since the day the country was split in two. South Korean media is responsible for originating some of the more outlandish rumors about the North. Rumors picked up by wire services and reported worldwide as fact that have turned out to be false. Such as the story that all university-aged North Korean men were required to get Kim Jong-un haircuts. As one South Korean journalist admitted, at his paper, the editorial policy goes that it is better to publish a lie or unconfirmed rumor about North Korea than nothing at all. Even when South Korean media cannot be relied upon to confirm our prejudices, elevating groundless speculation to the plateau of fact is the preferred tactic. Before the 2017 governmental ban on U.S. tourists visiting North Korea, the U.S. media drummed up its support by endlessly repeating the State Department's assertion that the money paid for these tours might be going toward the country's nuclear weapons program. Readers of such stories were, of course, easily led to ignore the conditional tense of that verb. In fact, would the State Department be so troubled as to sit down and talk with Simon from Koryo Tours, Alec from Tongil Tours, or any of the other Western travel agencies that bring tourists into North Korea? It could find out almost exactly where those tourism dollars are going. The cost breakdown for these all-inclusive tours is provided by their North Korean counterparts. Men like Comrade Kim at the Korean State Travel Company. The Air Koryo flights into and out of the country, or the train from China. The hotel, which varies depending on the quality of accommodation and amenities. The Sosan Hotel, where we're staying, is in the lower budget range of options. The cost of the mandatory two guides and driver. The cost of food for the duration of the trip. And so on. Not forgetting, of course, the commission that the Western tour companies, which are completely unaffiliated with the DPRK government, take as salary for their own guides who often accompany the groups, and as profit. Since North Korea remains an abstraction for so many of us, it is easy for us to base any number of assumptions on what little we are told. To imagine that every dollar spent goes directly into Kim Jong-un's personal coffers, rather than the reality that tourism in the DPRK is an industry composed of any number of competing profit-driven business enterprises. Perhaps this argument is still unconvincing for some. Sure, North Korea operates its own for-profit businesses just like anywhere else, one might say, but because of the vertical nature of the country's economy, there is always the remote possibility that any dollar spent there could, in fact, eventually go toward the development of nuclear weapons. In truth, owing to the secretive nature of the North Korean regime, nobody can know for sure where the small profit earned from tourism each year will go. North Korea does not publish statistics on the budget for its military defense, and because we refuse to have any diplomatic engagement with the North, it is impossible for us to gather that kind of information on the ground. We do know, however, that the profit earned by tourism is a relatively small figure, since the few tour agencies that take Western tourists to North Korea have openly divulged their numbers, around 5,000 tourists annually, as of 2017. By comparison, France receives more than 85 million tourists each year. There are other details of my personal life that I will not, cannot, disclose to Ms. Park. I cannot tell her that I do not, in fact, live alone in Berlin. There is no discourse on otherness here, an ethnically and sexually homogeneous nation. The first question I am asked each time I meet someone new is where my wife is. In an extremely conservative, traditional, family-centric land, cut off from the rest of the world, it is very difficult to fathom that one might elect, by either choice or born necessity, to live a different way. That a woman might, gasp, make the decision not to marry or have children. Or not to marry, yet have children anyway. Sex already is a taboo subject in this prudish society that will not even show two lovers kissing in its cinema. Sex education is completely absent from the educational curriculum. Homosexuality, as a concept, does not exist in the DPRK. Even though there is no law against it. Even though, with one of the world's largest standing armies, the act presumably goes on behind closed doors in the segregated barracks. There is no word for it. No identity concept to embrace. Most North Koreans, you ask, have